This is the best of the Adam Gold Show podcast, part of the Capital Broadcasting Podcast Network, brought to you by Capital Financial Advisory Group. Get your total retirement income plan by texting Adam to 21000.
All right, let's talk.
Enjoy the best of today's show. Here's Adam Gold.
So I think a lot of people talked about Sam Darnold being broken the last few weeks. I don't think any of those people meant it literally, but as it turns out, kinda. Fractured right shoulder. So in this case, in a way, at least fractured, not broken. So he'll sit for a few weeks, and the Panthers replaced one highly touted former USC quarterback with another when they signed Matt Barkley. Former Trojan Matt Barkley came off of Tennessee's practice squad. Why are you laughing?
Just the way you're saying it.
What? Is there a lie there?
No, it's all very true. You're stating just facts. I get it. It's just, every time I say those words over in my head, I'm just beside myself a little bit.
There was a time people thought Matt Barkley was going to be the first pick in the draft.
Yeah,
and that, it went back for one more year to Southern Cal, because why wouldn't you want to be the starting quarterback at Southern Cal?
Well, especially if you weren't going to be a good pro quarterback, might as well go
he
back.
He didn't
then.
Know that at the time, and it doesn't matter if you're going to be good. If you're going to be first, go get the money. Anyway, he went back to school. He didn't have a great year. Ended up being first pick in the fourth round, I believe.
I remember when he announced that he was going back. I mean, that's probably the main reason you do that.
I don't even know who drafted him.
You can make the big announcement in the stadium, and everybody can cheer you on.
Yeah, it's beautiful, man, especially Southern Cal.
Yeah.
They don't have cheerleaders in Southern Cal. They have song girls.
What does this do for you? What do you? What are we?
What do you mean?
What's the why? Why?
What do you mean why? Why sign him up?
Yeah, why
squad?
Sign him?
Because you need another quarterback. Darnold can't play.
Why?
Because you only have one.
No, you don't. You got a dude on the practice squad.
Who's the dude on the practice squad?
I don't know his name, but he's a dude on the practice squad.
So they're just going to bring up dude on the practice squad?
Yeah, what difference does it make?
Oh, because Matt Barkley is a former star. That's why.
No.
Look.
See, now you got to put, because you signed him off their practice squad, he's right. Got to be on your active roster.
For three games. Darnold's going to miss three games.
He
in three games, then you can put him out on the curb with the trash.
Okay. Well, then, again, why?
Because he's Matt Barkley. Look, here's what.
Don't do this. Don't carry the Matt Barkley water today.
Here's what MusicCityMiracles.com said about Matt Barkley and the Panthers signing him. The 31-year-old Barkley spent the preseason battling for Tennessee's number two quarterback job, but ultimately lost out to Logan Woodside and was released during final cuts.
Exactly. How do you lose to Logan Woodside?
Logan Woodside is he sells encyclopedias. Logan Woodside, door to door. Matt Barkley lost to an encyclopedia salesman.
Oh man.
Anyway,
Logan Woodside went to Toledo.
Did he?
Yeah.
The Rockets.
Yeah.
The Rocket lost to a Rocket.
It doesn't hurt you, but it doesn't help
they
you.
They needed
it
a quarterback.
Makes no difference if you have Matt Barkley or you have PJ Walker or you have whoever the dude's name is that's on the Panthers practice squad.
Tell me who the practice squad guy is, and we'll decide whether or not Matt Barkley is a better option than practice squad guy. And the truth is that you did want somebody probably taking some NFL snaps, although maybe that other guy had. Barkley has played some games, so. Look, it's just P.J. Walker.
James Morgan.
Hello. Oh, that's right. James Morgan. Wow. Well, we should have just elevated James Morgan.
Former FIU quarterback.
God, what a great player. Jets drafted him in the fourth round a couple of years ago. But the Jets, the Jets had a top five quarterback sitting on the bench and Mike White. More on Mike White later. Again, Barkley, former Southern Cal star. And they've had just such a pipeline of great quarterbacks come out of Southern Cal to make it big in the NFL. You remember all of them, right?
Carson Palmer.
Mark Sanchez.
Sanchez had a couple of good years.
They actually had some good quarterbacks back in the day. Todd Marinovich.
Mm.
Rodney Pete was Southern Cal quarterback. We liked Rodney
Todd,
Pete.
Todd was good for like a season
Todd
or two,
was
right?
Not good anywhere.
Okay.
Todd was never really good.
He had bigger issues.
He had much
than
bigger
just that.
Issues, no question
Barkley
about that.
Barkley has played, started 7 games in 6
See?
Seasons with Philadelphia, Chicago, and Buffalo.
I think Buffalo drafted him, didn't they?
Yes.
Did Buffalo draft him?
I believe
think,
so.
I think first pick in the fourth round. I don't
or
know.
No, I think Philadelphia
Philly?
Drafted him.
Oh, man. Surprised he didn't make it big there. Anyway, we will get the P.J. Walker era started this weekend. Is that at Arizona, right? We get a 3-game look probably at P.J. Walker. Very exciting.
Because we really need to find out what we have in
exactly.
P.J. Walker.
That's what I was told.
That's what Joe Person wrote about
find
yesterday.
Find out what you got in P.J. Walker.
We know. We know what we have in P.J. Walker. Athletic dude who does too much.
I love him. I'm a big P.J. Walker fan. I actually think that Matt Barkley will end up playing and being the star, and they'll get rid of Sam Darnold to keep Matt Barkley.
Whatever.
Right. I'm just
Matt Barkley.
I don't believe that either.
Bart Mackley. I don't care.
Oh, Bart Mackley is on Green Bay's practice squad. He's not available.
God.
He's not available.
Just I saw that news yesterday, and I'm like, really? Well, I don't. Why?
You know
why?
What? I think there's a Bart Mackley somewhere. I think there's a Bart Mackley somewhere. All right, let's get to basketball, Alec. Duke beat Kentucky at Madison Square Garden last night. More than 18,000 at the world's most famous arena for the doubleheader with 3 top 10 squads. Kansas ran Michigan State in the undercard. Then it was Duke hitting the second half accelerator in a 79-71 win over Kentucky. Mike Krzyzewski stating the obvious because there were 18,000 people at the Garden, and it was Duke and Kentucky, so it was big time.
It's just an amazing game tonight. I mean, felt so good with the Garden crowd playing against an outstanding team. I mean, they're tough, and we're tough. That was a big time game, and really big time. And our guys really fought through a lot of adversity. 4 of our guys got cramps in the second half. 2 of them had IVs. Paolo, you had an IV, right? And Wendell. And so our bench had to come through. And AJ really gave us a big lift. That was one of the keys to the game. And Theo, thank goodness we have him, you know, with his physicality. And for a while, Paolo carried us offensively, and then Trevor took over. But we have a good team. It's a young team. I mean, it's his first big game. I mean, for them to come through like that, I'm very proud of them.
First of
all, they're men.
First of all, in college, every team is young. But Duke's not that young a team.
No.
Maybe their 2 best players are young.
They're old. They're men.
But that's not a young team. Alec, first time in college basketball history that a pair of freshmen led a team in scoring when their head coach has more than 1,000 wins and is entering the final year of his coaching career.
Was that in the notes? Or
yes.
Is that your contribution?
That when I saw that stat, I thought, man, that is for Alec. That is a stat
that
for
is,
Alec.
Wow.
It was also the first time in college basketball history that a linebacker scored 25 points in his first college game at the Garden. Have you seen Trevor Keels?
Yeah. Well, Coach K actually referred to him as a running back.
That dude is grown.
He is, man. He is. Grown man.
Oh,
grown
my
man, grown man
gosh.
Strength. Grown man fearlessness. That dude, for a first game at Duke playing at Madison Square Garden, and basically was like, I don't care that I'm here in the Mecca. I don't care that I'm playing Kentucky right now. Like, I'm just going to take over the game right now.
He sought contact. It was great. Coach K talked specifically about Trevor.
This kid right here is going to be a great player. He's not a good player. Trevor's a great player. And, you know, he weighs 230 pounds. And if he was a running back, he would know how to pick holes. Like, you intimated Charlie. he gets fouled. He doesn't charge very much because he's so low and has great body control. And, you know, for three straight years, he was probably the best player in the D.C. area. So he's been on a lot of those summer games where it's on him.
He went right down Kentucky's B-gap pretty much all night long. It was also the first time in a farewell tour of a coaching legend that someone named Paolo looked like the first pick in the draft. Coach K talked about Banchero.
He's a lot better than he was a month ago because he's learned to play strong with the ball. And he over-dribbled a couple times, but usually he's been smart with it. And he's becoming a better athlete. He's a special player. And you can coach him hard. He's smart. I'd like to see him talk more. I said, why don't you say what you're thinking? Because he's thinking good stuff. And if he says it, that'll help lead. Wendell does that. I think if those two guys would do that more, we'd be better. But he's going to keep getting better.
There's a lot of potential there for this Blue Devils team. My two concerns, honestly, they gave up way too many offensive rebounds, and they were 1 of 13 from three-point range. They're going to have a three-point shot. Either it needs to be Wendell Moore, it needs to be Joey Baker, maybe Keels, maybe Banchero. Somebody's got to knock down threes. Otherwise, it's just going to be too hard for Trevor Keels is going to have too many people to knock over on the way to getting buckets. But impressive win last night. UNC and State also will never lose. Hubert Davis, I know did you see or hear the hype video that they put out for Hubert Davis's first game? I just thought it was inspiring's not the right word. I think, honestly, it just made you realize how special Hubert believes his position is. He loves the university so much. It is Hubert Davis. So I could not be more thrilled. He's one of the nicest human beings you'll ever meet. I think he's going to do a great job at UNC. And it's off to a good start. They beat Loyola. And Davis talked about kind of all those intangible things.
Well, the process of getting ready for the game and during the game was the same as it was against in the exhibition game with, Elizabeth City. You know, it's basketball, it's our team, it's our program. And so in terms of the preparation and during the play, everything else was the same. Where it was really emotional was after the game. You know, going through the tunnel, I saw, you know, my wife was there with my three kids. My oldest son, Elijah, is a freshman at University of Lynchburg. He had come back to be at my first game. My dad was there, my sister, Pete Chilcutt, who was my roommate here at Carolina. He flew from Sacramento, California, so he was in the tunnel. And so just seeing all of people that have been there for me my entire life, all the emotions that I have felt over the last 7 months just came. And one of the things that I always tell the guys, it's okay to be emotional because it means it cares. And I care about this place and this program and this university so much. And that was the only difference after the game, just seeing a lot of family and friends and it being a very emotional moment.
Look, the Carolina family is real. I mean, it's always been real. And I know UNC hates the Duke Brotherhood. They feel like they copied it. Yeah, they did. That's okay. You're not the only university that can do it. Yeah, UNC's family is absolutely legit, and there's going to be tons of former players there all year long. As for the game, like, it's hard to judge when you're playing against the team that you should destroy, and Carolina did that, but it does look like they've got tons of pieces. Like, I don't even know that I could think about anything from the game that makes me go, this might not be good, this might not be good, because they really were just, you know, they overwhelmed Loyola of Maryland. But Brady Manick is good. Dawson Garcia is good. So how does Dawson Garcia, actually, let me rephrase this. Dawson Garcia transferred from Marquette. Theo John from Duke transferred from Marquette. How did Marquette not win? How come Steve Wojciechowski's not the coach there anymore? He had two legit front court guys. So, because Dawson Garcia looks like a good player to me. Caleb Love, Kerwin Walton, Leaky Black, Armando Bacot. It's a good basketball team. I think it's going to be a good basketball team. All right, moving on to NC State. Tied at the half with Bucknell. But they put their foot on the gas in the second half, and they ran away. Got off to a rough start in a lot of ways. They were behind. They were, I think, 13-1 down. Manny Bates got hurt early. Kevin Keats loved the way his team handled it.
I don't know that we could have had a better opening game. And what I mean by that is just having some adversity. You look at it, they jumped out on us 13-1. We handled that. I thought we did a good job. Some guys came in off the bench and gave us a tremendous lift. We started off slow, finished the half, and then from that point on in the second half, I thought we did a tremendous job. We played NC State basketball in the second half. When you look at it, I think we outscored them 48-30. We were able to force them in some turnovers. Our young guys started to understand what we had to do in scouting reports and making the right play. And so I'm happy.
Again, a couple of things about State. First of all, Bucknell is a program with some pedigree in terms of they have been very good of late. So it's never going to be easy to beat a program that winning is kind of in their DNA. So not surprised they struggled early. Also not surprised they struggled early because Manny Bates got hurt. And he's going to have an MRI today, and hopefully he'll be okay. Terquavion Smith, yeah, fun. Just fun. Really good. Darian Sebron, perfect piece for the way they want to run their offense or run their defense because he's a headache everywhere. Cam Hayes, Jericho Helms, both really good. The only downer again was the Bates injury. Real quick, I was listening to Joe Giglio, who's host in the afternoon with Joe Ovius on our 99.9 The Fan affiliate in Raleigh. He did an interview with Kevin Keats that they aired yesterday. And there are facts, and then there's proper context. Here's a fact. This is year 5 for Kevin Keats at NC State, and they've been to 1 NCAA tournament in the first 4 years. Fact, right? 1 for 4. But now the context. They go in the first year, and then they lose in the first round. They win 24 games the second year, but were left out because the strength of schedule was one of the worst in the country. I frankly thought it was they left themselves open to that. And whatever. We can debate all day long whether or not they should have gone. You know, they certainly gave the committee the opportunity to deny them. Then the next season caught COVID, not State, the sport. So there was no NCAA tournament. In the 2020. There wasn't an NCAA tournament in the spring of 1920 either, Alec, just in case you're wondering. So we had a sport that caught COVID, and then last year was just a weird year start to finish. State had COVID issues on and off. Like, it was just a bad year for college basketball. So the way I look at it, Kevin Keats is 1 for 2. And if you wanted a debate that they got screwed in year 2, whatever, if you want to say that, I'm not going to argue with you about it. But so he's 1 for 2, not 1 for 4. By the way, in the ACC, not a good night for UVA, not a good night for Georgia Tech, not a good night for Pitt. All lost at home. Navy beat UVA from 8:45 until they hit a 3 with 15 seconds left. Virginia scored no points. 0 points. 0. What? Yes. Okay, we got to move on from that. I was staring. I was watching the highlights this morning going, why do they still have 55? How come they still have 55? They actually scored just 2 points in the last, like in a 10-minute stretch because it was the bucket they scored to make it 55 all, and they trailed at halftime. They scored, it might have even been 2 free throws. It's ridiculous. They just couldn't score at all. It's our friend Chip Patterson, CBSSports.com, Cover 3 podcast moderator. Thank you very much for spending time with us on a Wednesday, Chip. Who got screwed yesterday? Nobody.
No one got really screwed. I mean, so my big hang-up is less about the Michigan State thing. I was surprised. I thought Ole Miss was a little bit lower than I expected. I thought that BYU was a little bit higher than I expected. But I know that that's all with my quest to be able to actually figure out what these committee members are looking at, because I've decided that as the CFP Anon grouping of Tom Fornelli and Danny Cannell, they are tinfoil hatted all the way out.
CFP Anon? Did you just do that?
Yeah, CFP Anon. It was started by the shaman, Tom Fornelli, and Danny Cannell jumped on board. And I'm trying to jump on the other side to say, like, okay, look, these are very busy individuals who don't want to spend all of their time doing this. They're going to look for shortcuts. They're going to try to make this easy on themselves. And I've come close. The big thing is to actually get the strength of schedule metrics that ESPN provides.
Right.
And that does do a good job of providing some of the bigger picture. But no big arguments. You know, everyone's yelling about the Michigan State. Like, strength of schedule for Michigan State, 43. Strength of schedule for Michigan, 45. They're both 8-1. Best win for Michigan's going to be Wisconsin. Best win for Michigan State's going to be Michigan. The losses, Michigan's got a better loss, I guess, with Michigan State over Purdue. But the one thing that Gary Barta said that I think did stand out is that this Michigan State defense is a little bit leaky. Michigan had one of its best passing performances of the season against the Spartans. And then we saw again with Purdue, they moved the ball through the air. I think that is the very specific flaw that is the hang up for Michigan State right now, is that the pass defense is well below average.
Yeah, but I mean, didn't Michigan allow more points to Michigan State than Michigan State allowed to Michigan? I hate to be that guy, but look, and it only happened 9 days ago. But the truth is that if we're really arguing about which team should be sixth and which team should be seventh, then we're bored. There's nothing else to argue. We're no longer concerned about Cincinnati, apparently. Nobody complained about Cincinnati. Like, last week, everybody was mad because Cincinnati was sixth. They're fifth this week, and now people aren't mad.
I mean, it's because there's a ball don't lie situation from Tulsa, which suggests that Cincinnati, I called it running with an egg and a running with the egg and a spoon at the beginning of the season. And it feels like you're watching your friend at the relay race and it's getting wobbly. Like, yeah. It is over corrections left and right. They still have an awesome win with Notre Dame, but strength of schedule is 102.
Yeah.
I mean, that is an awful strength of schedule rating. And I think that has always been what has held Cincinnati back. And so when you have the on-field result against Tulsa, the way that it happened, I think that the Cincinnati echo chamber fighting for the little people, they had to go back in their holes after last week.
Yeah, look, I'm not in any way, I'm not trying to say that Cincinnati belongs, and that I'm not doing that. At the end of the season, we'll add it all up and we'll see where they do belong. But Notre Dame is their only good win. Their next best opponent, they haven't played yet, SMU. My guess is if they play Houston in the American Championship game, that will be clearly their second best opponent. And one, I think Houston is in the college football playoff ranking, but I'm not.
They're not.
They're whatever and one. But they haven't played anybody either. So
yeah, Houston is 8-1 with a strength of schedule rating of 123, 130 teams in college football. Its best win is SMU. And you know what Houston's second best win is? ECU. Go Pirates.
Look, I was looking at all the computer models. There's a website that does a composite of every, I guess, credible computer model. And that, I don't know if the committee uses things like that, but that kind of explains even more without the biases of, you know, the eye test and all of that the committee uses, I think, really to justify whatever they want. And like, I mean, there's only 25 teams in the ranking, but there are more games than that that should matter. So like the beauty of Alabama is not that they've beaten so many good teams, because honestly, they've probably only beaten one good team. And that's Ole Miss in terms of a top 25 team. But Mississippi State, Miami, Tennessee, and Florida are all top 50 teams.
Right. So they have better than five, or they are in that like above 500
right.
type conversation.
And of course, the best of Alabama is still to come. I don't know at the best. I mean, they could have beaten A&M. But Auburn and Arkansas are still to come, and the SEC title game, if they're in it, is still to come. And all the Big Ten teams, all of their schedule strength and their Q rating is going to go up. And Oklahoma sitting here undefeated and haven't played anybody yet. The best wins are Kansas State and Texas. But in the next 3 weeks, it's all going to – Oklahoma will either be in the top four or they will have a loss or two and not even be part of this. But if Oklahoma wins out, there's zero chance that they won't be in the four.
100% agree. But the big interesting debate is whether a one-loss Oklahoma team can make it to the college football playoff. Where is that loss? Who is it against? And what else needs to happen? I think right now one loss and Oklahoma's cooked, just because even with those good games left on the schedule, there's just going to be such a disadvantage in terms of schedule strength going up against some of these teams from the SEC and the Big Ten that might also be on the chopping block. But I understand that is a debate, and that is a legitimate unknown, just not only with the results yet to have happened, but you know, that is where it's going to fall back to. Okay, well, what does it look like? Because I will tell you what, man, Western Carolina, Tulane, and Nebraska, that non-conference is dragging the Sooners ranking down.
How about, real quick, away from the college football playoff, Nebraska bringing back Scott Frost. Is this essentially admitting that, you know what, we're not that good a job?
Ooh, in this market, when you've already got USC and LSU open, and when you think that if James Franklin is on the move, that Penn State might be looking for a new head coach, or if Mel Tucker is on the move, then
right.
Michigan State might be looking for a new head coach. The idea that you would be, like, even among your peers, be working down the pecking order before you are the most attractive job, I think that has to be part of your consideration. I also think that, you know, in the old, like, it's a coaching adage forever, but Rich Rodriguez told it to me, and he was being very kind with his time. It was like 2010. I was very young, and he was the first one to really unpack lose big, lose small, win big. And it does feel like Nebraska's losing small. Like, when they win, the few times that they have this season, three, they've blown opponents out. I mean, it's
right.
Fordham and Buffalo, but when they've gone up against the best teams on its schedule, they've been right there. And I think that if you're athletic director Trev Alberts, who just stepped into the job, and you know, you've got the whole, you know, connection to the program, I understand allowing Scott Frost to do exactly what Trev Alberts said, which is, quote, essentially, Scott is making a bet on himself. It is a renegotiated contract in which Scott Frost gets one more chance to be able to show he's got this thing going in the right direction and try for the first time since the prodigal son returned home to get the Cornhuskers to a bowl game.
I don't understand why he would do that, though.
Why Trev Alberts would do that?
Scott Frost would do that.
Like, why he would stick around?
No. Why he would, like, if you want to fire me, fire me.
I don't
to be fired. You love Nebraska so much, you're willing to give money back. I don't get. Here's my question. I want to go back to the playoff, but here's my question about Nebraska. With all of their history, and I realize that history can torture us, especially in college football, because the landscape has changed so much. But with all of their history, what is the justification that Nebraska is light years behind Iowa?
I don't think Nebraska. All right. So what is your definition of light years behind? Because I do not think that those two programs are worlds apart from each other. And I think that
One wins a lot and the other doesn't. So
what's, but even winning, like, I think that we are taking exceptions of years where Iowa flirts with that double digit. The Iowa season is 8-4. The Iowa season has a ceiling on it. And I think that that's where Nebraska, with its history, is thinking double-digit wins, compete for championships. But the realistic goal does need to be Iowa, where you are winning 8 games and you are turning in a consistent product and you are capitalizing on an area where you are the biggest deal in town. I think that for name, image, and likeness, that should be something where Nebraska is leaning into that local community. That's where, if you're looking for investment, if you're looking for support, I mean, we know all about the sellout streak, but what's behind that is a community that values its college football more than anything. The difficulty is on the recruiting trail, and Nebraska doesn't have necessarily the same opportunities that it did in the Big 12 to get down into Texas. And as it's playing in the Big 10, you're moving farther away from California, which is another spot where Nebraska has gone in the past. So it has to become a program development type place. And I think that that's something that's going to take a lot of time, especially in the early signing period. I mean, Scott Frost's, I think, first 2 recruiting classes were littered with guys who had a pretty good recruiting ranking, but the reason they didn't end up somewhere else is because those better programs stopped recruiting them, and there was a reason for that. And those guys are not in the program anymore. They have had tons of the top talent from the first couple recruiting classes leave the program, either by getting kicked off the team or deciding to transfer themselves. And so, like so many coaches here in the early signing period, it is a longer runway that you need to really get things going from a personnel standpoint.
All right, I just looked it up real quick. Not that I wasn't listening to you, because I was. Nebraska in the last 5 years has just been a dumpster fire. They haven't been ranked at the end of the season now since, 2012. They were ranked 25th at the end of the year, but 4 wins, 4 wins, 5 wins. Last year we can throw it away because obviously it was weird. But they were 3-5 last year, 3-7 so far this year. I mean, Iowa just feels like they're way ahead.
Oh, they are, but Iowa's been there though, right? I mean, you've got to look at Kirk Ferentz and all the time that he's spent.
No, I understand that.
Yeah,
to me, there just doesn't. Like, all the things in place. And now, look,
what's the light years? Stability. I don't know.
Right. And then Nebraska hasn't been able to do that. And maybe, I don't know, maybe they should have stuck with Bo Pelini. I'm not even arguing that that's what they should have done. But Nebraska was hung up on what they used to be, the Tom Osborne days. They were hung up on that. Frank Solich wasn't enough for them, even though he was winning 10 games, sort of like when Ohio State had to move on from John Cooper because all he could do was win 10 and couldn't beat Michigan, which I understand that whole rivalry thing. But it just seemed like they were stuck on their fantasy world of it can always be what it used to be rather than what is the reality of today. And by continuing to change and to go through Bill Callahan and Mike Riley and Bo Pelini, they were just like, just be the best you can be right now. It's probably what a lot of schools that used to be great that really can't be great anymore on a regular basis are kind of stuck on.
Nebraska and Tennessee were grouped together all offseason. I called them the dream of the 90s teams, and they were trying to do whatever they could to recapture this success that seemed so fleeting. And I will say it does look like Tennessee, even if it is just empty calories, even if it's just Halloween candy, at least they're out there scoring these touchdowns to be able to give their fans the Halloween candy that they need to be able to get excited about Saturdays.
It's time to talk to Trip Tracy because through technical glitches last night, I did not get a chance to enjoy the Bally's Sports South broadcast, and that might come up in conversation. And it was nobody's fault other than we'll just blame ESPN Plus. Trip Tracy, you're the man. How are you, sir?
AG, how are you doing, my dear friend?
Doing very well. I did listen to you guys, though, through the stream, so I was still listening to you and Mike while I was trying to figure out what was going on with the ESPN app. And I missed you guys because I thought the way that you talked about the first goal, the Alex Killorn interference that was allowed, was exactly the way you're supposed to do it. But we'll talk about that another time. I want to talk to you about process. And the way that Rod Brind'Amour processes things is I want it to look right, and then the results should come from that. And I thought that even had they lost the game last night, that the night in Tampa was a success, because I think they looked the part that we want for this team. How did you look at it?
You and I agree all the time. I mean, it's... I would have said, if it had gone deep in the third period, I had a feeling they'd get rewarded, but that absolutely would have been my post-game remarks, even if they hadn't won. They, in every sense, they looked the part. You know, in fairness, you know, Tampa didn't have Kucherov. They didn't have Sergachev serving a suspension. They lost Chernak early, and the Hurricanes took full advantage. That was a big part of the power play goal to tie the game. But, you know, we know the Hurricanes. You and I should be the Jerry Maguires for Brett Pesce and Niederreiter the way he's played. So both teams were missing critical pieces. Adam, to play that type of hockey against Tampa, even if it had been a superhuman 1-0 shutout, I would have had the same conclusion as you. As a matter of fact, I had it in my head, AG, right before Teravainen scored the power play goal, I was going to tell a story. I never know what I'm going to say, but I was reflecting back to a game. It was game 5 in the first round, 2009, the series against the Devils.
Okay.
What a battle that was. And the Hurricanes lost 1-0. Brodeur was unbelievable. And I typically did not go near Jim Rutherford on the bus after a loss. So I walked by him. I didn't talk to him, but I texted him and I said, "Jimmy, did the Hurricanes just lose the game but win the series?" And he typically wouldn't get back to me because, my gosh, he'd smoke out of his ears after a loss. And he wrote back and he said, "I think you're right." And so when the Canes came back and really pummeled the Devils in game 6 and then came from behind one game 7 in dramatic fashion. So with the performance that Vasilevsky was putting forth, with the fact that, you know, you have a back-to-back Stanley Cup champion, that would have been my mindset had Carolina lost the game, that they may have lost the game but got over the hump against the champs. I mean, it's just one game in the regular season, but that would have been a strong feeling.
Yeah, especially coming off the loss at Florida where Carolina just looked poor. But they hadn't really – I mean, I thought the best game they had played really in the last 2 weeks was the home win over Toronto. I mean, I didn't think they were all that dangerous against Boston. They were good, but they weren't great. But I thought that was the best game they had played until last night. And I thought what was interesting to me is that I felt like they were forcing Tampa to react to them as opposed to the other way around. I thought Carolina dictated the game last night. Just to get back to you, our love of Brett Pesce. Last year, when Jacob Slavin was out with COVID in the beginning of the year, it was the game at home against Tampa. I was in the building for that, where Brett Pesce played, I don't know, it was like 28 minutes, and he was just everywhere doing everything. Wasn't that Slavin last night?
It sure was. When I think about Slavin's game, there was one play in the third period where Braden Point, we know his elite level, and Tampa loves to come up the ice with speed, which is a challenge in and of itself for a defenseman or anybody tracking back. And then they love to cut up because you're so worried about their speed. Cutting up's a smart move because it creates all sorts of time and space. And seamlessly, Point went from north-south to east-west, and Slavin stuck with him, I mean, like a glove. And that was his entire game. And I'll tell you this. You know, I've talked to you before about how much I've learned from, you know, my regular chats with Scotty Bowman. He was at the game last night.
Oh, okay.
And he called me on the bus to the plane after the game. And he said, "Wow, Jacob Slavin is as well-conditioned of an athlete as I've seen in some time. And I said, well, Scotty, this head strength and conditioning coach, Bill Berniston, sitting right next to me. So coming from Scotty Bowman, he's going to enjoy that. And so you combine that power, that fitness, but then his most important attribute, his mind. And there was, you know, he set up that goal, tough night, we all know, in Florida on Saturday night. But he sets up that goal, jumping down below the goal line and finding Jesper Fast. And I talked to him on Sunday in Tampa. And he looked at me candidly and he goes, Tripp, why? I can't remember which Florida defenseman was trying to seal him below the goal line, AG. And he goes to me, he goes, why would a guy, if you're ever going in to try to, you know, win a battle in the corner, come with your stick anywhere but on the ice?
Right.
And he said, the moment I saw that, I knew that the passing lane was available, and he found Jesper Fast. His hockey IQ, like when they broke in all at the same time, chronologically, what, it was Hanifin and then Pesci and then Slavin.
Right.
He had talked about the skating ability of Noah Hanifin. That's why he went in, you know, high in that 2015 first round. And then the galloping ability of Pesci. Slavin is an excellent skater and has gotten better and better, but yeah, he makes himself infinitely better in the way that he moves because his mind is on a different level. His hockey sense is through the stratosphere.
Yeah, it's just incredible. He played more at even strength last night than all the other defensemen except for Tony DeAngelo, who only got him by about 20 seconds. He played 19-10 at even strength. He played more like 27-33. In all situations. One more thing, Andrei Svechnikov, who I thought had a very power forward-ish game last night. I loved Andrei last night. The stuff that Rod will really love, and I'm sure is probably looking at it right now, the back check on Cirelli, I believe it was in overtime, to deny what I think was going to be a goal. Because Cirelli made a great move across the crease in front of Anderson. Those are the kind of things that Andre's getting better and better at that will, I don't know, maybe eventually lead him to kill penalties too. But he was great last night.
He was great, and I dial it back to, I don't think it was anything significant, but, you know, he didn't practice Monday. And so then you're wondering, is anything wrong with Andre? And then he looked just A-okay in the morning skate yesterday. And, you know, you looked, and even though they've been producing with regards to points, he and Sebastian hadn't scored, I think, the last three or four games.
Right.
And how they get back to their game is different for both guys. And for Andre, it's being a true power forward. I mean, that hit, I talked to him about it on the plane, just walking onto the plane. I said, Andre, that was Ryan McDonough. I mean, that's as strong on his skates, as girthy of a defenseman as there is in the league. And, mm-hmm. and he said, I don't know that McDonough thought it was coming. It was a thunderous hit.
Yeah.
Thunderous. I said, you know what? You just about ended the highlight reel portion because you had a grade A chance 5 seconds after. And he goes, I know, my brother. I was wondering if he was coming for me, and he missed the net. And then, you know, before the play that you astutely talk about in overtime, Jordan Staal won the opening faceoff in overtime, came on for Andre, and Andre, Peter Forsberg, I think it was Belmar, you know, the old reverse hit. I mean, with, again, thunder. I mean, he had an Ivan Drago, I will break you type night. And then he gets back on Cirelli and comes underneath the stick and underneath the hands. So there's really no way that you can call a penalty there, although everything on earth has been called on Svechnikov in his career. So he not only worked, but he worked smartly. And I can tell you, I know that he would love to be a guy at some point in time that Rod would trust killing penalties, because he wants to be in every situation. And mm-hmm. I would think that when you talk about the process – that you began this afternoon hot stove, you know, making sure that was and is the theme. He only helps himself of getting that opportunity with plays like that.
Yeah, it was just a tremendous play. And final thing for Tripp Tracy, Frederik Andersen. Is there a way? Are you surprised that he has been this good?
No. No, because you and I were together in the first preseason game. It was against Tampa. I know Tampa didn't have an NHL lineup at all.
Right.
It was my first chance to really watch him. I had had dinner with him early in the preseason, so got to know him and started to observe what a professional he is. And then that game against Tampa, not against an NHL lineup, but the calm, cool nature, but then the athleticism that I didn't recognize calling his games as a Duck and calling his games as a Maple Leaf. I said, wow, this is a different level than what we've seen, if it can be maintained, and gives you a chance to go toe-to-toe with the game's finest goaltender in Vasilevsky. Cam Ward, I've mentioned it a few times, reached out to me right after the Hurricanes signed him, and he said he's going to flourish in Carolina because there's structure in Carolina, and he's going to trust the defense in front of him to do their job so he could be more committed to his job. Last night, I mean, he didn't see a lot of quantity, but I was our stats guy in Tampa, I think, had it on the mark. And I talked to Chris Offhide today, the video coach for the Hurricanes, and he agreed. The chances, despite the differential in shots on goal, I think the chances were 19-16 for Carolina. So that just tells you how good Freddie was, Adam. And that is such a high degree of difficulty. I mean, whenever I was at my best at college or whatever, I always struggled in the games where I'd see somewhere between 18 and 25 shots because your brain can be a real detriment. You're watching the guy at the other end stand on his head. You try to do too much. You put pressure on yourself because you see the way the boys are playing in front of you. So for him to make those high caliber saves when you think the chances were pretty darn close to even was another signature night. And it should, again, when you think of the process. Now, we get down the road and, you know, the Hurricanes qualify for the playoffs. The next challenge for Freddie is going to be winning in the playoffs.
Right, because that has not happened, right.
That'll be the story. But, you know, like you look at it and it's a small snippet. It's one game. But the way Anderson had played in October, the way he played in Chicago, and the way he went one-on-one with Vasilevsky and came away with a win, that gives you, again, in the process, believe that you have a real chance of getting over the hump.
I'm looking forward to Friday against the Philadelphia Flyers. That should be a blast. Couple of home games, and then you go out west for the next couple of weeks. Trip, I appreciate your time. We'll talk to you next week, my friend.
AG, great to be with you as always. I can't wait to see you Friday.
Oh, by the way, I was at Jack's hockey game this past weekend. Credit to him, he picked up a double minor for roughing. I had some parents come up and compliment the Carpat dig-in hoodie.
Yeah, I was actually just – I know you got to run, but I was just on a text with Aho and Tara Vinen because I guess it was Tavo's name day in Finland
yesterday.
And I said, boys, I said, you know, when I come to Carpat and Oulu, is that what I'm – is there a name day over there for Trip? And Sebastian was laughing. He said, it's not an official name over there. So, but classic. Yeah, that, you know, that's a beautiful hoodie. But the best part about it is that because of you and the others that purchased it, we were able to make a significant donation to the Oulu All-Stars charity that Sebastian is really passionate about.
Dig in with Trip. And go to digintrip.com. Get your stuff. Alex got a cool hat. We'll talk to you next week, sir.
See you, AG.
You've been listening to the best of the Adam Gold Show podcast, part of the Capital Broadcasting Podcast Network, brought to you by Capital Financial Advisory Group. Get your total retirement income plan by texting Adam to 21000. Don't forget, this podcast drops every weekday at 3 p.m. Or you can find it at WRALSportsFan.com, the WRAL Sports Fan app, or you can subscribe for free at the iTunes and Google Play stores.